Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'll be speaking today with Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean of Berkeley Law School. His latest book is Worse Than Nothing, The Dangerous Fallacy of Originalism, and you can learn more at law.berkeley.edu. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. I assume that listeners to this show have heard some of what I'm about to say before. Minority rule, as practiced by today's Republican Party, cannot and will not respond effectively to the most critical challenges we face. Inequality, climate change, an unhealthy relationship with the rest of nature, pandemics and public health, social and racial division and tribalism, crippled government, and endangered democracy. I believe also that sustained minority rule not only produces unpopular policies, but also weakens and sickens democracy, breeding cynicism, resignation, and the sorts of tribal divisions we now face. The U.S. holds only one national popular vote, that for president and vice president. The Republican Party has won that national vote only once since 1988. That's 35 years. Think about that. Yet they have held the presidency nearly 12 of those years, and currently also hold half the Senate, though they've received millions of fewer votes than the Democrats in Senate elections, and as a result, they dominate the Supreme Court. I think the Supreme Court is the form of minority rule that upsets me the most. Preparing for this conversation, at times I found myself feeling a visceral sense of impotence and hopelessness. A president who lost the popular vote nominates a justice who is then confirmed by a Senate that represents a minority of the population. Brett Kavanaugh, for example, confirmed by senators representing only 44% of the population. Democrats have won the popular vote, as I said, in seven of the last eight elections, but during this time, the presidents of both parties have each appointed five Supreme Court justices. Since 1960, though the number of years each party has held the presidency are about the same, Republican presidents have named 16 Supreme Court justices. Democratic presidents have picked only 9. Some of that is simply the structure of government, the rules of the game, the Electoral College, the makeup of the Senate. Part of it is luck, when lifetime appointees happen to die. And part of it I see as illegitimate, the result of Mitch McConnell's extra-constitutional abuse of the system, refusing to deal with Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland and rushing through the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett. In a recent Zoom conversation with my brothers and sisters, we were talking about Tom Hartman's recent book, The Hidden History of American Democracy. And we all agreed that having been lucky enough, or perhaps simply old enough, to have had civics classes, we had learned about the three co-equal branches of government and about the founders' design of checks and balances, both of which, Hartman reveals, are nowhere to be found in the Constitution. He points out, however, that the Constitution at the very least suggests, by the order in which they appear in the document, that Congress comes first, followed by the executive, and then the courts. And that is also the order of how democratic they each are, how representative they are of we the people. I turn to Erwin Chemerinsky when I want articulate and meaningful commentary and analysis regarding questions of justice, our legal system, and the courts. Since this will be a little less than a half hour, we will move quickly. But Professor Chemerinsky is so clear and concise in his thinking that it's always more than worth it. Erwin Chemerinsky became Dean of Berkeley Law in mid-2017. From 2008 to 2017, he was the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at UC Irvine School of Law. Prior to that, he was a law professor at Duke University and at the University of Southern California Law School. In 2017, National Jurist magazine named him as the most influential person in legal education in the U.S. Chemerinsky is the author of more than 200 law review articles, and his books include The Conservative Assault on the Constitution and The Case Against the Supreme Court. His latest is Worse Than Nothing, The Dangerous Fallacy of Originalism. In it, he points out that the primary purported benefit of originalism is in constraining judges, preventing them from deciding cases according to their personal moral preferences. But does it achieve that goal? I would forcefully say no when it comes to the current 6-3 majority. And, he writes, assuming for the sake of argument that it does, then the next question must be, do the benefits thus gained outweigh the costs of limiting constitutional meaning to that from 1787 when it was written, or 1791 when the Bill of Rights was added, or 1868 when the 14th Amendment was ratified? He lists a number of rights that are considered to be constitutionally protected, but that appear nowhere in the document. The right to marry, the right to procreate, the right to have custody of your children. You get the idea. He writes that originalism can be defined in a way that provides significant constraints on justices, but only at the price of such unacceptable results. Along the way, he states that, quote, we can define judicial activism and restraint in functional terms. A decision is activist if it strikes down laws and restrained if it upholds them. It is activist if it overrules precedent and restrained if it follows precedent. It is activist if it rules broadly and restrained if it rules narrowly. He then cites District of Columbia versus Heller and Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, two hallmark cases of the Roberts Court, one ruling for the first time that a law regulating firearms violated the Second Amendment, the other protecting the right to unlimited corporate spending in election campaigns. And he notes that each declares unconstitutional law adopted in the legislative process, each overrules precedent, and each was a broad ruling when the court could have ruled more narrowly. He ends the preface with these words, quote, originalism is not an interpretive theory. It is just the rhetoric conservative justices use to make it seem that they are not imposing their own values when they are doing exactly that. His goal, he states, is to help expose originalism as a dangerous fallacy. Welcome, Erwin Chemerinsky, to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this interview Thursday, July 27th.
It's a pleasure to be talking with you. Thank you so much for the kind introduction.
So let me ask first for your response to this Supreme Court, the overall big picture response, its approach, its aims, its self-definitions, the rulings this term, its cumulative record so far. What's your sense of this court? This is the 6-3 conservative majority court.
It is a very conservative court. It is following the conservative Republican agenda. In just the last couple of years, it's overruled Roe versus Wade and ended abortion rights after 49 years. It's eliminated affirmative action by colleges and universities for 45 years. It's provided for the first time the ability of people to violate anti-discrimination laws on account of their beliefs.
So what we have is a series of radical opinions over the last 2 years with a clear agenda. And then let me add on to that, Professor Chemerinsky, your response to the investigative reporting that has revealed all of the ethical lapses.
I think it's important to separate the ideology of the court from the ethical issues surrounding the court. Ethics should have no ideology. It is unconscionable that the most powerful judges in the country are the only ones who aren't governed by a code of ethics. Every state judge, every other federal judge has a code of ethics. I think the ethical improprieties that are revealed by Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch tarnish the court. And I think it is so wrong and unfortunate that when the Senate Judiciary Committee voted on creating a code of ethics for the Supreme Court, the Democrats voted in favor and the Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee voted against. Ethics should not be a partisan issue.
Right. Given that it didn't pass, it's not going to pass the Senate, and Chief Justice Roberts has said it's unnecessary, is there any avenue for actually holding them to some ethical standards?
I would hope the intense public criticism for the lack of a code of ethics, and I would hope the Supreme Court's very low legitimacy and approval ratings might cause the court to on its own adopt an ethics code. If not, I think Congress is going to have to force the court to do so, even if this isn't the Congress that will do that.
Okay, so it may be a matter of time. If we're talking about this most recent term, there were a few moderate rulings by the court in Harper versus Moore. They didn't go so far as to sanction the state legislature's right to overrule the popular vote. They told Alabama that it had to redraw its districts to give blacks more representation, which the Alabama legislature is choosing to ignore. And then in the last week, they hit three big decisions that you mentioned in your first answer. Let's talk first about Creative 303. Colorado web site designer seeks relief from the hypothetical request of a wedding invitation for a same-sex marriage, a ruling which elevates religious bigotry over civil rights. Your thoughts about that decision?
I think it is a tragic decision that opens the door widely to an exception to anti-discrimination laws. It's not just a case about people who discriminate on account of religious beliefs. It could be any beliefs. It's not just about sexual orientation discrimination. It could be about race discrimination. Anyone who's involved in what they claim to be expressive activity now won't have to follow state anti-discrimination laws. Another way to put it, there's always a tension between liberty and equality. Any law that prohibits discrimination, by definition, limits the freedom to discriminate. For decades, the Supreme Court has said that stopping discrimination is more important than protecting a freedom to discriminate. 303 Creative versus Alena is so troubling because the first time the Supreme Court has said there's a constitutional right under the First Amendment to discriminate.
And so what's interesting here is, as you point out, it isn't limited to religious beliefs, right? It's on what grounds does the claimant have to say, I deserve the right to discriminate?
The claimant has to say that he or she is involved in expressive activity. And the court says no one be compelled to engage in expressive activity. So if somebody says, designing and baking a cake is my expressive activity, then they don't have to serve anyone they don't want to serve. If somebody says, cutting hair is my expressive activity, they don't have to serve anyone they don't want to serve.
I mean, It's so outrageous given, I mean, as you're saying those words, I'm thinking about everything we've seen since the early 60s, where the right to discriminate was sort of taken for granted as not possible in these United States.
In all of the cases in the 1960s that involved anti-discrimination law, those who wanted to discriminate always claimed that they had a First Amendment right to do so. It was their freedom of association. Mm-hmm. It was their expression. And the Supreme Court always rejected that argument. It made clear that stopping discrimination is more important than a right to discriminate. In 303 Creative, the Supreme Court said that those who are involved in expressive activity can discriminate on any basis, whether it's race, sexual orientation, and on the basis of any beliefs that they have.
First of all, I'm thinking most people probably don't realize it was that broad. As I stated at the start, religious bigotry trumping civil rights. But as you point out, it's more about that freedom to express trumping freedom to do most anything.
That's right. This says no one can be forced to engage in expressive activity that they don't want to do. So if they don't want to serve blacks and they're involved in expressive activity, they don't have to. They say, my expressive activity is cooking food, or my expressive activity is making cabinetry, or my expressive activity is taking photos. They don't have to serve blacks or women or Jews or gays or lesbians or anyone else they don't want to serve.
Okay. I can't imagine what is going to happen next on this. I guess our only hope is that if cases come up in that vein, that some of that 6-3 majority will have a change of heart.
My guess is that when the case comes up involving race discrimination, some of those 6-3 majority will have a change of heart. I think the fact that this is about sex orientation discrimination reflects their underlying attitudes about that.
That's right. Yeah. And so just to just put a pin in your current book, or the Worse Than Nothing about originalism, which, as you point out, the purported goal is to keep people, judges, from just enforcing their own moral opinions. This court, in the last 2 years, it seems to me, has, in a series of decisions, done exactly that.
I think any court inevitably is going to produce decisions that reflect the ideology of its members. I think the hypocrisy here is that the conservatives are pretending they're doing something different when, of course, they're imposing their own values. This is the court that overruled Roe versus Wade, like conservatives have wanted for decades. This is the court that expanded gun rights in an unprecedented way, like conservatives have wanted for decades. This is a court that ended affirmative action by college universities, like conservatives have wanted for decades. No one should believe that this is a court following some neutral law. It's following the Republican platform.
It is. And a pretty far right even version of the Republican platform. Okay, let's move to another decision then, the student loan forgiveness. You've written, in striking down the Biden administration's student loan forgiveness, the Supreme Court ignored one of the most basic principles of law. When the text of a law is clear, it must be followed unless it is unconstitutional. Explain.
There's a federal statute. It's called the HEROES Act. And it says that the Secretary of Education can, quote, waive or modify student loan obligations in an emergency. This is the authority President Trump used to suspend student loan repayment requirements early in the pandemic. President Biden continued it, and then President Biden made it permanent. The text is clear. The Secretary of Education can waive student loan obligations. President Biden did this for about 43 million Americans, up to $20,000 per person in relief. As Justice Kagan said in her dissent, the statute can't, within the English language, be clear.
That's right.
And yet the Supreme Court, 6-3, invalidated this.
Now, one of the things they used, another one, we've talked about originalism, another one of their doctrines, and I say there because I hadn't heard about it until they started calling on it, is their what they call the major questions doctrines, which, if I'm not mistaken, is nowhere defined. Where does it come from?
It comes from the Supreme Court in very recently.
Yep.
Most law professors, most judges hadn't heard about it until very recently. The Supreme Court has invented this principle that in order for a federal agency to act on a major question of economic or political significance, there must be clear direction from Congress. The Supreme Court says, forgiving this much student loans is a major question of economic or political significance. There must be clear direction from Congress. But of course, here there was clear direction.
That's right.
Congress said the Secretary of Education can waive student loan obligations. But that wasn't specific enough to satisfy Chief Justice Roberts' conservative majority.
And the danger, it seems to me, with this major questions doctrine is you can, if you want, as a justice or a group of justices, a majority of justices, decide anything might be a major question, and then decide, as they did in this case, that the direction is not clear enough, specific enough.
That's exactly right, because the Supreme Court has never defined what's a major question of economic or political significance. The court's never defined what's enough guidance from Congress to meet this doctrine. I was speaking in Washington, D.C., and a number of lawyers came up to me and said, their clients now believe that everything is a major question. Anything that an agency's done, regulating health or safety, or the environment, regulating business, they want to argue is a major question, and Congress wasn't sufficiently specific. This has opened the door to challenges to every kind of federal regulation.
Yeah, I hope people hear that. every kind of Fed regulation. And as I pointed out in the introduction, we have a number of crises. And if you just looked at climate change or environmental health, this notion that something like the Clean Water Act is not specific enough to govern that stream or that wetland is really dangerous.
Congress inevitably has to give broad delegations of power to agencies. Congress can't regulate the specific amount of water pollutants that will go into the river or the amount of a particular kind of pollution that go into the air. That's why we have agencies. And what the Supreme Court is doing in a very conservative direction is limiting the power of agencies to follow federal statutes and to protect the environment, to protect health and safety, to protect us from unscrupulous business practices.
Yeah, I mean, it's to me, it's a notion that if you sat around as a bunch of, you know, first-year law students and somebody threw this out, that people would go, that's ridiculous. It's absurd. The Congress couldn't rule that specifically. They don't have time. It's just impossible. And yet they have decided that this is the way the U.S. government should function, though it hasn't functioned that way for its history.
The Supreme Court only twice in all of American history, both times in 1935, found a federal law to be unconstitutional because Congress had delegated too much power to the administrative agencies. Since 1935, without exception, the Supreme Court has allowed broad delegations of power because it's the only way that agencies can deal with the problems facing society. It's the only way that Congress can deal with urgent social problems. But now the Supreme Court is very much limiting what agencies can do, especially when they're doing things that conservatives don't like regulating greenhouse gas emissions or providing student loan relief.
Okay, let's finally turn to affirmative action. You have written, from an originalist perspective, affirmative action is clearly constitutional. There's no basis for concluding that those who wrote the Constitution or who drafted and ratified the 14th Amendment ever meant to create a requirement for colorblindness. And yet that is what they've turned to, as they did in overturning the section of the Voting Rights Act a few years ago.
The framers of the 14th Amendment adopted many programs that were race-based. The Freedmen's Bureau, programs to help those who were black soldiers, and so on. So if one really wanted to follow originalism, it's clear that the original understanding of the 14th Amendment allowed what today we would call affirmative action. But of course, the conservatives on the court consider those originalists don't pay any attention to that. They're following their ideology, not the original meaning of the Constitution.
Okay, let me just say thank you, Erwin Chemerinsky, and keep up your good work.
Thank you for having me on, and I'm always glad to talk to you.
Again, the newest book is Worse Than Nothing, The Dangerous Fallacy of Originalism, and the website is law.berkeley.edu. Then search for Chemerinsky, Chemerinsky. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of guests and issues, plus usually 8 to 15 links to articles to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at TEMcNally@mac.com, TEMcNally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts and at other podcast sites. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at most of those sites. Listen anytime, anywhere. Archives include Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer, and so on. You can also follow me on Twitter, @McNallyTerrence. Thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely.